This is CliffCentral.com.
Fear's a powerful thing, and it's got a lot of firepower. If you can figure out a way to wrestle that fear, to push you from behind rather than stand in front of you, that's very powerful.
I have a dream.
Multiplying leadership, moving society, the millennial way.
You don't want to end up going after goals and dreams and neglect yourself.
Welcome to the Youth Leadership Platform with your host, Bongani Dao.
Listen, take control. Take control of your city. This is the instrument of your liberation.
See, old friend, I brought more soldiers than you did.
Identify yourself to the world.
Youth Leadership Platform.
All right. Welcome to the Youth Leadership Platform with your host, Bongani Dao. We're in the building again, and we are doing amazing things with amazing guests. Today's guest, promises to bring us a lot of insight into the hashtag #TumaMina campaign that is ran, obviously, by the ANC under the leadership of President Cyril Ramaphosa. And today's guest is a well-esteemed, powerful, I'd say young woman, but she is a woman of no small reputation. She is a member of parliament in the National Council of Provinces and the Provincial Whip of Gauteng and Whip of Finance and Appropriation Committees. And this is Tasneem Mutara. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Bongani. How are you?
Thank you so much for coming to the show. I'm well.
Thanks for having me.
besides the flu, which is something you can get over, I think I'm doing all right.
Yeah.
So hashtag #TumaMina is in full swing. You are part of one of the biggest political parties in South Africa, shaping and moving the country. There's a lot of commotion that's going on in the country currently. So we're going to have, a youth leadership glimpse on the current affairs and the political climate within the South African context. But before then, I'd love for our listeners to get a insight of who is Tasneem. So if you can take us to the younger version of you. Yeah. Who was she? Where did she grow up? And what were some of her aspirations in life?
Well, I'm young, but I'm not youth. I'm 35 years old. I am the second youngest member of the ANC in parliament. Younger than me is Mdu Manana.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's a year younger than me. Well, I grew up and still live in Benoni on the East Rand. Yes, I love it. I'm not going to leave anytime soon.
East Rand.
I love it. I mean, it's a nice place to grow up in. Lived there all my life. Went to school there. I finished school at Benoni High School.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yes.
Primary? Where did you go?
I went to two primary schools, Benoni West Primary.
Okay.
And St. Dominic's for Girls.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So, you can tell education was a very strong point for my parents. They looked for what you can coin as good schools.
Within and around Benoni.
In Benoni, yes.
Okay.
So we went to relatively good schools. I grew up in a big family. We five siblings. So our friends were each other, that sort of thing. I grew up with extremely strict parents.
So that must have reflected on your report card.
Possibly.
Straight A's, nothing less.
Yeah, never got into trouble, never bunked school, never did any of those teenage-y things. I missed out on those. I think I was just too petrified of my parents.
But is that a good or a bad thing?
I think it's a good thing. I'm glad.
Oh,
I am.
Okay.
I am. Because when I started exploring and doing things, I was more mature and could decide for myself. Yeah.
What you want and what you don't want.
It definitely.
But didn't it have an impact on that? Because then at this point, you're sort of having a reflective experience of what teenage years would have given you.
No, look, I wasn't detached from what was happening around me. Yes. I mean, I had friends at school, you know.
And, yeah.
Yeah, so I wasn't detached from what was happening around me. It's just that I was too petrified to do it myself.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was just... I always had images of my mom and my dad, like, slaughtering me, you know, killing me alive.
Really?
So I just, yeah, so I just never...
That's intense.
Yeah, they were quite strict. It never happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just had images of it, of the possibility. So, so that's where I grew up. I did a lot of extracurricular activities. I played tennis. I was a drum majorette. Yeah, I was... That's what I did. I played chess for the school.
Mm-hmm. Are you good at chess?
Yeah, I am.
Could you take me down? Well, that's relative.
Relative, yeah. I know I probably couldn't beat the former president, Jacob Zuma.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, probably not. But, I mean, I could give you a run.
Oh, is he that good?
Apparently, he's a maestro at the chess game.
Oh, interesting, okay.
Yeah, so... That's, and I mean, I still live there. My family still lives in Benoni, my immediate family.
So what were your aspirations growing up in Benoni?
So growing up, I think my ideas of what life should look like and like social problems and social ills and that sort of thing really came to the fore for me once I left school.
Okay.
When you're forced sort of to interact with society at a broader level.
Sure.
You know, school environment can be closed somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
Although you come from different backgrounds, the school environment sort of protects you.
Sure.
So being forced to live now outside a very protected environment makes you see things that your peers go through, for instance. Mm-hmm. I remember during the election campaign of, oh sure, I mustn't get this wrong, 2005, it was Thabo Mbeki's second term of office. We had arranged to go to Modibe Prison.
Okay.
To do electoral campaigning and to get inmates to register and that sort of thing.
So already from that level, you were involved with
the
political party.
Interesting. Okay. So we went there and I met an inmate who was a student with me at primary school. And I think that was like quite shocking. He was serving time for credit card fraud.
Sheesh.
So he had studied, finished school, gone to university. I think he worked for one of the big banks, obviously one of the big banks, I can't remember which.
Sure.
But he was involved in credit card fraud and he was serving time for it. And it just showed that, you know, you can go to school with somebody, but where you end up is basically, it's choices. Because I don't think he was forced into credit card fraud.
Yeah.
And also don't think you have to have some level of brain matter to engage
to
in something.
Especially
in a work environment, because, I mean, you use the work environment.
But now, were you thinking about being within, you know, having a bigger role within the political party itself or having a career outside of that, just participating, but something outside of politics?
Well, I grew up in a very political home.
Mm-hmm.
My parents, I mean, are still politically active.
Sure.
My dad is a local government councillor, has been for, I think, 3 or 4 terms now. I can't even remember.
Oh, okay.
So growing up, all I knew was the ANC.
Sure.
And to some extent, I had a sort of negative view of the ANC because it kept my parents away from home.
Okay.
So I knew that, you know, I just don't want to be involved in politics. I'll vote if I have to vote, but just to be, because I don't want to do that to my kids. You know, my life mustn't be consumed
sure,
by it.
Sure.
So for a while, I sort of like stayed away from it, was quite averse to it. Until, you know, when you resist something for long enough, it sort of like pulls you in anyway.
Yeah.
And I got pulled in anyway. I remember it was at a time in Benoni when they were establishing youth league structures.
Okay.
And they were looking for like young people who could be involved in establishing youth league structures. So my sisters got involved, my
sure.
two younger sisters, they got involved. And then I joined the mother body, the ANC.
Sure.
So they led me in the youth league, and then the ANC, they went off to, my sisters went off to varsity, continued with student politics there. The ANC then deployed me to go and re-establish youth league structures in Burundi. Okay. Which I did.
Yeah.
Quite successfully. Yeah, and then the political bug just split.
and you're like, I'm in it.
So
might as well.
I think to be in representative public space was not really something that I was working towards.
Okay.
I think I just enjoyed working in the ANC.
Sure.
Working in the structures, using the ANC to serve the community, that sort of things. The opportunity to serve in Parliament came in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
I was a member of the Provincial Executive Committee of the ANC Youth League.
Okay.
And through that process, I was nominated into the ANC's list process.
Sure.
But I remember thinking very little of it. I was like quite low on the list. but I mean, I was, for me, just making it on the list was a great achievement.
Sure.
I was like, it was just amazing. Just to see your name published on the list was good enough for me. So we continued with election work. I remember I had to vote as an early voter because I was representing South Africa at United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
At United Nations Youth, it was the process of the development goals, the sustainable development goals that we have now.
Sure.
So I was representing South Africa at UN Youth, and it was at Sri Lanka. And we were leaving the day before elections. So I had to register as a special voter.
Sure.
So I was going to be out of the country. I registered, I voted, and left. And then we were watching the voting results from Sri Lanka, and they were so scary. Man, they were shocking for the ANC especially.
Yeah.
And I was on the provincial list. So I think I was more worried about people who were in the legislature, who were not going to make it back. And, you know, a lot of them thinking, oh, the ANC has just like lost so many seats.
Sure, sure.
I came back from Sri Lanka, went to work, and then I got a call from the now Premier, David Makura. At the time, he was the provincial secretary of the ANC.
Sure.
And he called me to come and see me at his office. And I thought, he probably wants to like say, okay, you didn't make it, and I thought, okay, there's no need really, you know.
You
I'm
can
fine.
Just tell me over the phone or
yeah,
email.
Yeah, like I'm fine, you know. You don't have to do this whole emotional thing. I'm cool.
Sure.
And he called me. I went to his office, and then he told me, you better resign immediately. You're going to Cape Town, and we're sending you to represent Gauteng in the National Council of Provinces.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's how quick it happened. So I resigned, went home. I remember having to buy a dress, something formal to wear.
Sure, sure.
And I had to leave to Cape Town to be sworn in later that week.
Hmm. And how has the experience been? So how has the experience been after mm-hmm. that as well? What are your key responsibilities in that portfolio?
Well, I think for me now, the biggest change has been the fact that now I think I know that every day, regardless of whatever I do, every day has a direct impact on more people.
Okay.
So I'm in the Finance and Appropriations Committees. So whether it's oversight, whether it's approving the budget,
sure.
I know that somebody's life is impacted and probably somebody I'm never going to meet. So working in ANC structures meant that I worked with ANC members.
Okay.
A lot of the time. And it's people that you know, people that you serve with on an ongoing basis. And the space is smaller than in representative politics.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always at the top of my mind.
Sure.
Knowing that whatever I do, every day, somebody's life is going to be impacted.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's up to me whether I impact that life positively or negatively.
Sure.
So I'm always conscious of that. So I guess it's a greater responsibility, and I take that as just not just a privilege, but like that responsibility has to be taken seriously.
Sure.
So that is the big difference, really, mm-hmm. from just serving in a political party, making sure the political party grows, remains, wins elections, to now putting into action what the political party has said.
Well, so, and then what is the responsibility of a chief whip?
Okay, so in the National Council of Provinces, we are the nine provinces are represented there, and each provincial delegation is led by a whip, provincial whip.
Okay.
So you have the chief whip of the council, who is a whip of all members, but each province has got a whip that leads the delegation.
Sure.
Is a link between what happens in parliament and the provincial legislature.
Oh, okay.
So I liaise with the provincial legislature on an ongoing basis on a number of issues, whether it's laws that we are passing, legislation, whether it's input into legislation, programs in provinces, issues that the legislature wants to be raised at a national level. So, for instance, a few years ago, it was actually the term before I joined parliament, the issue of acid mine drainage in the West Rand, which is water is a national competence. And for national government to be able to address that issue, it had to go through a process that fed into the National Council of Provinces. So it became a national issue through the legislature and then the National Council of Provinces. Otherwise, you find that a lot of things that are supposed to be taken over by national government doesn't really, because they remain within the legislatures. And there are a number of other examples, but the acid mine drainage is probably one of the most recent, especially for Gauteng.
And you're also involved in a lot of youth leadership programs that run. I'm of the mind that a month or so ago, you were in France, engaged in one such program. Take us through that. What's entailed there?
Okay,
and what are the objectives?
The French government, what they do is every year they identify future leaders across the world to participate in a future leader program in France.
What's the criteria? Do you know?
There's no specific criteria.
Okay.
It's through diplomatic channels. So the embassies in a country would sort of watch, keep their ear on the ground, and look to see who are young and upcoming future leaders in that country. And then what they do is they nominate you to the French government. And motivate as to why they think this person should participate. So they have, I think, approximately 80 participants per year, but they come from all over. I know Lindiwe Mazibuko was one.
A few years ago
when she was still a member of parliament. And there have been other South Africans that have been part of the program. What it entails is you give them your focus areas and areas that you are currently or futuristically looking at. And then they set up panels, they set up interviews, meetings with very high level relevant people in the different sectors. So that's what it was, and my interests really are on the fourth industrial revolution.
Okay, let's discuss that.
Yeah, so my interests in relation to the fourth industrial revolution is how will it change or affect or impact governance.
Okay.
And how is it going to affect or impact democracy?
Sure.
So, for instance, we now. For instance, I'm now a member of the Constitutional Review Committee. We're going around the country discussing and looking for views around the Section 25 of the Constitution, amending or not.
Okay.
So it is a person-to-person process. We've had in excess of 500,000 written submissions.
Okay.
And then on any given day, we listen to 200 submissions, personal submissions. Now, if you take into consideration the fourth industrial revolution, it's going to change how societies or communities interact with legislators.
Okay.
You don't have to do a face-to-face interaction.
Interview or interaction, sure.
Definitely. You can get real-time responses on service delivery issues, which in some places is happening, where the government is at a level to respond mm-hmm. as quick as people are able to
send in the request,
send or complain or register their issues.
Sure.
Is what we need to answer. So, what are the types of skills that government must recruit to be able to respond to citizens who are actively participating in a society channeled by the fourth industrial revolution? Democracies, how is it going to change democracies? Is there going to be a need for public representatives or parliament as an institution the way we see today? So if you look back in like real way back when history, you had monarchs.
Sure.
Which don't really serve a purpose today.
Today, yeah.
Yeah, they're ceremonial, they, you know, they're there, whether they're not there.
It doesn't make any difference.
It doesn't. The state continues. You have multilateral institutions, which don't necessarily play a big role in terms of what they should be doing. Will the fourth industrial revolution change that? Will it make states as independent entities, the way we understand them now, mm-hmm. irrelevant?
Mm-hmm.
And will multilateral institutions become the new world order, the new state, as we understand it, for regulating how people work, how people live? Because because if you, the monarchs did that, regulated how people, how societies operate. States do that now. And multilateral organizations are really just a platform for engagement. Is the fourth industrial revolution going to force multilaterals to be more active instead of just an engagement platform? So how is democracy going to change? And then the last aspect that I looked at on the fourth industrial revolution is, of course, youth and how they, how societies or how governments, whether they are or aren't, readying society and young people to be able to engage fruitfully. So our school systems are still very rigid. You go to school at 8, you
come out at
3, you have 2 lunch breaks, and that's not necessarily the way it should work. You know, I mean, I visited a business hub, an incubation hub in France.
Okay.
Nobody has an office.
Interesting.
People just sort of sit wherever, do their work. It's free. It's not, there's structure, but it's not the structure that you, that we've become accustomed to.
Yeah.
The new face of a working environment has to feed into the new face of a school environment as well, because you can't. I mean, that's why people, when you've gone to school for 12 years, you sat behind a desk next to the window for 12 years. Automatically, you're gonna think that the best job is behind a desk.
Behind a desk, yeah.
In my office. Or, that's what you're going to think.
Sure.
Because you've, I mean, for 12 years, you've been conditioned that way to think that this is success. This is a sign of me doing well. And it's not necessarily the case. I mean, you can, the fourth industrial revolution really speaks to the productivity of people.
Okay.
You know, so you've got to create spaces and environments and structures and support for real productivity out of people. And I don't think, definitely not in South Africa and Africa as a whole, but I don't think we're there yet, creating opportunities for pure productivity. I mean, you can be productive in 3 hours in a day, as to opposed to working 6 hours
hour shifts,
exactly.
Yeah.
And you're just not productive, but I'm getting many work hours out of you. And
then you're just claiming a lot of money as well.
Exactly.
What were some of your experiences with Jacob Zuma before we move into Cyril Ramaphosa and the current campaign that's currently going on?
Okay, well, let me say, okay, I don't have personal experiences with him. Just really work-related, ANC-related. I think I said it even in an interview in France.
Sure.
And I said that South Africa is a very, it's not a nation state.
Okay.
So it's a very dynamic place. Each individual identifies with leaders based on a number of aspects.
Sure. Personal to them.
Personal to them.
Sure. Which makes it very difficult, right?
Exactly. It makes it very difficult to find one sort of central figure that people can rally around, because
sure,
some others are just not going to identify with that person. They'd rather identify with somebody completely opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it's really because, look, like I say, South Africa is not a nation state. It's a secular state, yes, so it doesn't have religion as the basis of identity either.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a whole mixed pot that people want to relate to. And I said that if we ignore the fact that Jacob Zuma is a leader to many, many South African people, the ANC will be to the ANC's detriment.
Okay.
But in the same way, the ANC has to accept and realize that many, many people within the ANC are leaders in their own right.
Mm.
And find ways of harnessing that in a collective way to be able to draw ordinary South Africans that support and are followed by them. So I think he does have a role to play in terms of balancing the support base of the ANC. We've seen the ANC's support base shift.
Sure.
In terms of class.
Some capital states as well.
Definitely.
Metropolitan cities.
Exactly.
Sure.
You know, metropolitans are even more difficult to really get the flavor of what they want.
What I found interesting is, I think Kerry Morgan from mm-hmm. ENCA tweeted once, and she said something along the lines of, I'll be delivering an address to a group of students,
mm-hmm.
and I'll be speaking about she spoke about, yeah, some things that would have had negative
mm-hmm.
impact on the country,
mm-hmm.
and then she goes on to say, the former president
mm-hmm.
is not one of them. But I'm like, this person is from an organization and a media platform
yeah.
that has spent the last 9 years really preaching one narrative mm-hmm. about the man.
Vilifying
him. Exactly.
Exactly.
And then to come out and then tweet something like that. What are your thoughts on that?
Look, I did see the tweet, actually. And I thought, the ANC, possibly, not only the ANC, I think governments as a whole across the world,
mm-hmm.
wherever I've traveled, I mean, I've heard this, have a love-hate relationship with the media
mm-hmm.
as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure if you spoke to Donald Trump, he would...
But he's a troll.
Well, you would... He would give you his real opinion about the media. I think... if you understand simplistically that the media is about, it's
sensation, maybe?
Not even sensation, it's an enterprise.
Okay.
So it's about the bottom line.
Sure.
And really simplistically, I don't think good stories sell.
Oh, okay.
But that's being really simplistic,
sure,
you know?
Sure, sure.
And there's always been an argument about what is the role of media in a democracy.
Sure.
What is the, you know, that sort of thing. And I think even the media itself is struggling to answer that. What should our role be? I think if you look at mainstream journalists today, there's nothing they can say without adding Jacob Zuma somewhere in the headline, even if it's so not related
to him.
Definitely. Yeah. You know, somehow they've got to throw the man's name in just so they stay relevant, you know.
And selling, I guess.
Yeah, selling, those headlines sell, that sort of thing.
Well, in any case, moving along to Cyril Ramaphosa, he came in, I guess, guns blazing. There's a lot of media coverage about how he's tightening the grip on power. You know, I guess he comes in as a national favorite. Even even a lot of media seems to be rallying behind him. And he's coined his campaign, Tumamina. Mm-hmm. One of the things that have come transitioning from Jacob Zuma to Cyril Ramaphosa is the promise of free education. How is that structured to be sustainable over the years? Because there were discussions around how that's not feasible in today's economy, where we're going to harvest the money to be able to finance such a system or program. Mm.
Okay, nothing in the world is really ever free.
Sure.
You know, I think, and that's what we all have to understand as South Africans. So if we move together from that angle, I think we'll be able to accept. It will be free for some, but nothing is ever really free.
Okay.
Whether it's sustainable or not, I think, personally, I do think it's sustainable.
Okay.
Just to
come in there, who is it free for?
Okay. So we have what in South Africa is called missing middle.
Okay.
It's people that just don't earn enough or they earn too much. So they're in a gap. They don't earn enough to sustain their lives or to get a bond or to, you know, those types of things.
Sure.
But they earn too much to be considered indigent.
Sure.
You know? We've created this big bulge, a balloon of that in South Africa. So it's meant to be free for them, and then of course the poor.
Okay.
So I think it is sustainable. I do, however, and I think I'm going to be quite controversial and say that there are some decisions that the ANC has taken that is not sustainable. One of them could be free housing.
Okay.
It's a moving target. I don't think we'll ever get to a point where we've housed everybody who needs to be housed for free. It's just not sustainable.
Sure.
So there are some things as the programmatic that the ANC has engaged in that need to be re-looked at and have to be stopped in order to pay for something that has more longevity and is more sustainable and can give back to society. Because if a person has a free house, more than likely rates are free, services are free.
Sure.
And without saying it's a burden to the state, but that the state looks after that person in totality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a huge cost to the state. Now, you want a cost to the state to be a forward investment. So it's fine for the state to derive cost today. But if there's a future benefit and investment
from that,
yeah. Why not?
Okay.
And I think the ANC has to now make some really, really tough decisions and say, whatever we're spending on, whatever we are investing in, there must be a return on investment in the future.
Hmm.
And that's why I think education, free education, is sustainable, but it must come at a cost of cutting other things that are just not.
So is that probably part of the explanation for the 1% increase in VAT?
Sure. Okay, the 1% increase in VAT... Okay, from a purely financial perspective, because I think some of these things, of course, the decisions that politicians make up are politicized.
Sure.
But from a purely financial perspective, governments have few bases of income.
Okay.
So it's tax, revenues, it's it's trade tax. Basically, it's your basket of taxes.
Sure.
So whether it's trade revenue, personal income tax, company tax, that sort of thing, that's the base that government must work at. And I think it's definitely it's a regressive tax. VAT is regressive.
Mm-hmm.
Because it pushes the prices of everything up. The cost of living goes up exponentially. Food, traveling, the cost of transporting food and that sort of thing goes
sure.
up.
Sure.
So it is regressive. But the fact of the matter is that South Africa is at a stagnant growth rate.
Okay.
So we've reached the limit of growth. And that is our problem.
So we are... break even. We're making enough to sustain everything that's currently going on.
And the fact is that if we don't increase our tax base, we're going to sit with this problem perpetually.
Petrol hikes.
Yeah, the bane of everyone's existence.
You know.
Definitely.
You know.
The Parliament is... There is a process now with Parliament going to look at how our fuel prices are determined.
Mm-hmm.
So remember that our fuel price is determined by a number of different parts that make up a fuel price per litre. So you have the road accident fund, you have the fuel levy, you have the price of fuel per barrel against the dollar and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Things that we can't control, we will be unfortunate. We just can't control them, like the price of Brent crude against the dollar. But things that we can control, we should control in the interests of South Africans.
Sure.
And I think, it's an argument that we had. I remember even when I was in the provincial executive of the Youth League, we were fighting the introduction of e-tolls back then.
Sure.
And we said that the e-tolls are fine. It's great. In fact, extend the roads, make them beautiful. It's a pleasure to drive from the East Rand, where I live, to Pretoria now. It is. But there's no alternative. I don't have a choice of getting into public transport. I don't have a choice of using a cheaper alternative.
Sure.
If I want to get from Benoni to Pretoria, I have to get in my car and drive.
Sure.
So it's that those are the problems.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fine to introduce high fuel price, but you're not giving anybody an alternative in terms of public transport. In terms of, for instance, we import so much.
Sure.
Instead of locally cultivating, growing, producing, because when you grow, produce, manufacture locally, you drive prices down.
Mm-hmm.
If you are importing really simple things, the prices are going to stay up. And then to sustain that, you've got to increase everything.
So it's a manipulation of stuff that's not state-owned to...
It is.
...kind of help the state to
And it's
functional.
It's a vicious circle. So, we're doing things because they're urgent.
Yeah.
They have to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But the long-term ill effects of those are going to be detrimental.
Okay.
Mm.
Interesting. Entrepreneurship. Well, before we get into that, mm-hmm. the youth unemployment rate in South Africa is at a staggering, about, 40%?
Mm-hmm.
Plus, minus, give or take. And it's very alarming. There mm-hmm. was a point in time where teachers would say to students, you need a good degree to get a good job. But now we see a lot of youth with mm-hmm. good degrees, good education, and skills as well, but without jobs. Mm-hmm. What's the plan?
Okay, I'm also going to be controversial and say okay. that a lot of we have to look at a lot of our labor laws.
Sure.
You would have, if you want the economy to grow, you've got to please the growers of the economy.
Okay.
Of course, without taking away rights of workers and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the labor, the the market has said that our labor laws are too rigid. So people are almost afraid to employ because you employ somebody, workers have more rights than an employer.
Sure.
Yet it's a cost to an employer. So those are some of the things that we've got to look at. You want to create favorable conditions for employers to go out and do exactly that, which is to employ.
Sure.
And I think that's it goes back to what I was saying earlier. If we don't grow our tax base, we're going to be stuck in this rut. So growing your tax base means having more people employed. I don't buy into the narrative that says that there are no jobs or that the job market is saturated. I think the job market isn't saturated, but I just think that there isn't a willingness on the side of business owners to employ. Entrepreneurship is slightly different.
But now, in that, mm-hmm. that willingness,
mm.
from you know, a government point of view, mm. what can be done? Because I'm thinking about all the students that don't have power really to take on private sector and say, we want to be employed, employ us, mm. right?
And it that's where government comes in.
Sure, sure.
Mm. And government has got to, like I said, look at things like labor laws.
Okay.
What is it that employers are saying are making them averse to employing? Labor laws, they just feel that, you know, once you employ somebody, you can't get rid of somebody who is not productive.
Mm-hmm.
You're sort of stuck. That's why there's such a big boom in labor broking, so that the employers don't take on that risk, because it's a cost to them. They'd rather go through a broker. The person never becomes permanently employed.
Okay.
Exactly. So they shift that risk. And government has got to address that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm at. By no means am I saying that we need to relax labor laws to a point where employers just exploit employees, workers, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely we've got to protect workers and their rights and their right to other services.
Sure.
Such as medical aid, pension funds, good working conditions, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to sort of segment the arguments and the discussion and say, what in terms of workers' rights are we protecting and not willing to settle on or
yeah.
give up?
Sure.
Once we can say these are the basket of goods or services or things that must accrue to workers, we can then go into what are the employers' concerns.
Mm.
And I think if we sort of strike a middle ground, employers will want to employ.
Sure.
That's really in terms of like bigger companies that have the employment capacity and that sort of thing. And government has got to look at those labor laws. We do.
Interesting. I think we can leave it to you to take it up with them, and then
definitely
we can do a follow up on this to say what is the progress, what are we looking at, you mm. know, how can the youth as well get engaged in helping to find solutions to such a big problem. Another aspect or topic I wanted us to touch on was how a lot of entrepreneurship hubs mm. are situated in city centers
mm.
and just in overall progressive places, where if you think about the community and the market that they're mm-hmm. trying to serve,
mm-hmm.
that's a market that already has access to resources. Mm. But when you go to townships and where it matters most, mm-hmm. there aren't any of those hubs and, mm-hmm. and resources. So what's the plan there?
Okay, so the current provincial government here in Gauteng has engaged in a policy position and direction that says we need to revitalize townships.
Sure.
Not South Africa. Let me say Gauteng is made up of probably equal amounts of townships as equal amounts of suburbs.
Okay.
So that's the apartheid spatial planning. And I think what happened was probably post 1994, there wasn't a lot of focus given to townships because the argument was always that we don't want to replicate the apartheid spatial planning. But the reality is that many people in our townships want to live there. They want to remain living there. It's where they've lived. It's they want services to be there.
Sure.
You know, if we can tar their roads, give them water, give them electricity, bring services closer to them, they're more than likely not going to leave and live in a suburb. It takes away, there's that community element that you have in a township that you don't have in a suburb. And that's what our people enjoy. So the past 4 years, well, let me say 3 years, there's been a concerted effort to revitalize townships. So a lot of enterprise development has gone into townships. It's worked in some instances. In some cases, it hasn't.
Are you involving the youth from the township?
Definitely, okay. Yes. So that's it. And I think that's where the balance or the delicateness in the in what you try to do as government comes in. So, for instance, I know in the East Rand, we have a jewelry manufacturing.
Okay.
And that includes people like youth from the township.
Sure.
And that has worked quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And then in other areas, you would have had a type of township industry that hasn't worked well because that's not what young people are looking to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the type of trial and error sort of thing that
that's currently going
on. That government has to engage on, okay. Unfortunately. So you'll have areas that work, areas that don't, areas that take off.
And it's trying to find that balance between the two.
And what works in Tembisa may not work in Soshanguve.
Sure, sure.
And really trying to find, you know, what exactly works here.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. I want to bring somebody on to the show, and then we'll continue the conversation.
Okay.
She is no stranger to the show. She is a fabulous and wonderful humanitarian person, and who's doing really, really, really incredible work worldwide. And if I'm not wrong, she's currently in Cape Town, engaged in a very important program at Robben Island. If you're wondering who I'm talking about, I'm talking about Catherine Constantinides. Catherine, hello, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to chat to you.
Thank you so much for taking the time out. I know how incredibly busy you are, and we practically hijacked you. So thank you so much for taking the time out.
No problem.
So what's currently going on at Robben Island as we speak?
Well, as we speak, I'm standing outside of Tata's prison, and we're going through, I'm here with the British High Commission, and today we decided to spend the day together with 60 children from Guluthu, Philippi, Langa, children that have never had the opportunity and probably will never come to Robben Island.
Oh, wow.
On an important day ahead of the centenary and Mandela 100, before Mandela Day, our service is to really share special experience with these children by not only teaching them about the history, but teaching them about the history in the place of history. And alongside doing that and spending the day on Robben Island, we've also been engaged in a cleanup of this island.
Oh, wow.
And I must sadly, sadly say that the condition of the island outside of where prison cells are, you know, just sort of on periphery where people don't necessarily go, is really, really shocking. There are layers and layers of waste and litter.
Jeez.
And it's important that we take responsibility and we start to clean up. This is not only a historical site, but a heritage site.
Yes,
and
yes.
Today has really been, you know, I knew that there was a lot of litter, and that's why the cleanup was designated for this island. But my goodness, we have to, as South Africans, take pride in our national heritage sites. And we've been teaching these children about the importance of them understanding that they have the responsibility of their own waste. We often think that waste and litter is somewhere because of something, but we're the human beings that are putting it there. So we have to reconsider the environment, because the political prisoners who were on this island and gave their lives for us did not want to see the history and legacy being left in a condition like this.
Shucks. I hope, you know, this is resonating with a lot of people, and that with a lot of our listeners currently listening to the show will take note of that and take action. And you are giving, I'm off my mind, you also giving a talk on Wednesday, which happens to be coincidentally Mandela's birthday, at the Power Summit. Would you kindly give us a brief about that?
Absolutely. So this coming Wednesday, as we celebrate Mandela Day, I'm very honored to be amongst one of a group of unbelievable South African women who have been dubbed powerful women of the country, who will spend the day really engaging on discussions as to how we move South Africa forward, what every person is doing in their own individual spaces, and how these trailblazers are really pioneering in their specific fields. So I'll be amongst them, our very own Terry Peto, Nomzamo, to name but a few, Tina Foster, and there's many others. But I'm really excited and really honored to be able to share my story and to be chosen amongst these women to share Mandela Day with other young women and other South Africans as we share our story. And mine specifically, very inspired by the great man himself and the man of the day, Ave and Tata, I had the privilege of spending a great deal of time with, sure. But I know with that privilege comes a great responsibility.
Definitely, and you know, responsibility, you're showing a great deal of that in everything that you're doing worldwide. And I think there's a lot that the youth can learn from your example. And I guess as part of your parting words, because you don't want to take a lot of your time currently engaged in a very important work, what kind of message would you like to send out to our listeners?
I think the message I'd like to leave with the listeners of the show is just that as we go into this week, where there's so many things happening, so many Mandela Day projects, so many initiatives around the country, and different people embarking on different things, I hope that we will also spend a moment to reflect on the values that this great leader left us with, the values that resonate with us, and how we can, in each of our everyday journeys, actually take those values and implement them in the way that we live, and let us live selflessly to lead in our individual spaces. We don't have to have a title to lead. The heroes that we're waiting for rest within us. And it's really up to us to do something. We have the most beautiful country in the world, and we are the ones that are the custodians of that beauty. But it's what we do with it that matters most.
Wow. That is Catherine Costantinides. Catch her at a Power Summit on Wednesday. Currently engaged in a very important work. They are visiting with 60 children at the Robben Island. Thank you so much for joining us on the Youth Leadership Platform.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity. And I hope to see you all out at the Power Summit on Wednesday. But if you're not coming, I'm wishing you all an amazing Mandela Day week, because there's a great deal of activity happening across the country.
Sure. Thank you so much. Well, I'll be there, so we'll chat some more there.
See you and catching up. Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
Awesome. That was Catherine Costantinides. Now back to the studio with Tasneem Motara, who serves as the Member of Parliament. Talking about Tumamina, pretty much, and what's in it for the youth of South Africa. So we've covered a lot of base in terms of free education, entrepreneurship, some of the key changes that need to come in where labor law is related to kind of accommodate and bring down the tragic statistics of youth unemployment currently sitting in around plus minus 40% in South Africa. What are some of the key strategies, maybe we could choose your top three from the top of your head, that are going to be initiated in Cyril's term, even if it's just this proxy term before the official voting happens, that are going to be of great benefit to the youth of South Africa?
Well, you would know that he's on a drive to fundraise investment for some of the work that needs to be done.
Sure.
So the work that needs to be done would range from infrastructure building programs and that sort of thing. And like I said earlier, you know, if government is going to spend, there's got to be a return on investment.
Sure.
And I think that's what he is focusing on. So that investment would have to look at big capital projects, infrastructure that would bring market linkages, whether it's from our neighbors or even across the borders. That would make that's one of the things that he's driving. The other would be sort of a wholesale cleanup and rationalization of state-owned entities.
Okay.
Which I think is important, definitely, but notwithstanding the fact that it's got to be to the benefit of South Africans.
Okay.
Because you don't want to sort of give up a state-owned entity that is going to just cause us new problems.
Sure.
And probably the third would just, I think his rallying call around Tumamina is just about all South Africans sort of lending their hand and putting their shoulder to the wheel to assist or do whatever they can in their space to get South Africa going forward.
Wow.
Okay. So that's whether you're in the corporate space, professional, NGO.
Sure.
It doesn't matter. But there's something that we can, each one of us, do that will contribute towards moving South Africa.
Great. In the great. I think your story is inspiring, and I think a lot of young women listening to the show right now would love to hear, I guess, a parting message from Tasneem Mutara, you know, overlooking mm-hmm. everything that you've experienced. Just briefly.
Sure. For women, specifically sure. young ladies, sure. I think we live in a wonderful country that mm-hmm. has looked at women specifically to be able to empower them and put them a step ahead of their peers. And the opportunities are there. They are numerous, and they need for us to go forward and grab them.
Sure.
I think South Africans for a long time have been used to handouts and have become sort of a society that waits for things to be done for them.
For them, okay.
Instead of going out to do it for themselves. And I just want to say that South Africans let's use what we have to get what we want.
Right.
And we can get it all.
Wow. Thank you so much for joining us on the Youth Leadership Platform. For all of those listening, that was Tasneem Mutara and Catherine Costantinides talking about the Power Summit that we have been invited to happening at the Lyric Theatre on Wednesday. Do catch the podcast on cliffcentral.com.
This is cliffcentral.com.